Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Each weekday morning, Roundtable host Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Monday, the 22nd, Joe was joined by Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, Robert Brigham, Preceptor in Public Speaking, Strategic Communications, and Public Relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, and Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer.
Lee Stefanik has said she is dropping her bid for New York governor. And not only is she dropping her bid for New York governor, she is going to leave Congress, and she is out as of the end of her term. And this just comes days after Republican Bruce Blakeman, who, like Stefanik, is a close Trump ally, and he said he intended to challenge her in the upcoming primary in the 2026 governor's race. Stefanik quickly racked up a very impressive list of county leaders and Republican leaders within, not county, in the district. And it seemed like that was going in her direction. But then the president, who is friends with both, but perhaps maybe not as much with Lee Stefanik as she thought, did not tip his hand and said that he would endorse, but not he didn't know who, and they were both friends, and there was no ringing endorsement coming, I would say, and that on top of poll numbers that were very early, but quite discouraging, I think, as far as looking at where she stood of some 30 points. And the governor was had both better approval ratings and higher numbers in that race, Governor Kathy Hochul. So Stefanik had announced her bid to challenge Kathy Hochul in early November, and by mid-December decided that she was going to step out of the race. And not only that, but step out of Congress as well. We can talk about some of the other things that may have led to this. I mean, she was on a track for the second term just at the beginning of this year, nominated for UN ambassador. But then her nomination was withdrawn. And that was due to considerations over the Republicans' majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. But it was and then she was sort of promised a leadership position, and then she sort of, well, she didn't get one. and then there was sort of a freezing out by Mike Johnson, and then in the beginning of the race in November, she set her eyes on making Zoran Mamdani the devil, and that worked really well until the devil appeared in the devil's White House, and they got along. So then that didn't work out well for her either. And one person said to President Trump during that meeting, he said, "Well, Lee Stefanik has called Mamdani a jihadist," and Trump said, "Well, those are the things you say when you're just running for office." I think that was also a tell. Just for fun, the last Republican governor of New York served until 2007, and that was George Pataki. Okay. Am I the only person who – not your rep, right?
No.
Yeah, okay. So I think I'm the only person who serves as our rep. So I'll turn it over to the people who have some distance on this. Bo, what do you think?
Got a lot to say about this one, Joe. In some ways, what's interesting to me is that her political career, the descent of her political career, is probably as swift as the ascent was. And so it's interesting to think about. So A couple of things that I'll throw out on the table for the folks to talk about. The tough primary with Blakeman. These are the reasons why Stefanik is out. The uphill battle in the general election. The Siena poll came out and showed that she was 19 points behind. I thought this was interesting data. She was underwater in the favorability rating. This recently came out too. 28% of New Yorkers had a favorable rating of Stefanik, 36% unfavorable. But the more interesting number is the one-third of New Yorkers who were either unsure or didn't know who she was, right? So when you compare that to Hochul, Hochul's got a 43% favorable rating and a 45% unfavorable rating, but still only 15% don't know who the governor is. So,
and I'm just going to interrupt for 1 second, and I apologize, but I heard in the news coverage all weekend about the likening of Stefanik to the problems that Marjorie Taylor Greene had,
right?
Because Greene also obviously left the Congress and the party. Well, not the party, but left the Congress and the Trump bandwagon because of the relationship they had. But the difference there, of course, is exactly what you just mentioned. I think. In a nationwide poll, people know who Marjorie Taylor Greene
Correct.
Is, whereas Elise Stefanik, even though she held powerful positions within the halls of Congress and was a very staunch ally of the president, was less known nationwide.
Yes, and I think that if you go back to, what was it, a year ago when she was, or a year and a half ago, whenever it was when she was taking on the Ivy League presidents,
yes.
her name recognition was huge at that point. There's so many pieces to this, Joe. One of the pieces to this is when you get pushed out by leadership, and whether it was a kind of a foolish move on her part to sort of tag herself to the UN ambassadorship. But when you get pushed out of leadership, and Kevin McCarthy is not Mike Johnson, and Mike Johnson is not Kevin McCarthy, and Stefanik doesn't have a platform anymore, you got to find another way to have a platform. And I think she thought the governorship was going to be the way in which she could find sort of resurgence in her career. Marjorie Taylor Greene is always going to be out front because of the fact that she's vocal anti-Trump at the moment and so on. Stefanik is walking that fine line. So I do want to eventually talk about I'm going to pass it on to the group, but I do want to eventually talk about the number of people who are leaving Congress, especially in the GOP. I'll leave it at that, but I have a couple of other things to say about Stefanik at the moment, but let's hear from others.
All right. A teaser. Thank you very much, Bo. Terry Gibson, what do you make of this?
Well, I think that it does point to what is an ongoing perception based on a lot of evidence that the Republican Party is not a welcoming place for women that want to rise up and have places of authority. We see time and time again that the Trump administration and his allies really just don't like women getting too much control. And anytime we see that happen, we often see them being pushed aside. So from that perspective, this being a misogynistic administration, I think that has to be read into this, because it's whatever you think of Stefanik, whether you like her or hate her, she was and still is, if given the opportunity, a talented politician that did rise up and find a way to get up through all the noise and become a very prominent person in that party for a short time. What's strange to me about it is that she started off on a rather sort of moderate place, which most Republicans in New York are, because of the need to just survive. If you're too extreme, New York isn't a place that supports a whole lot of that. But she pretty quickly began to change and become more and more extreme, more and more conservative, and more supportive of Donald Trump. I think that was a big mistake for her politically. I think if she had stayed a moderate, I think if she had stayed a person that sort of was kind of walking that fine line and calling out Trump from time to time, I think she might have found herself being more successful, having more opportunities. I think she discovered that by becoming a person that screams and yells a lot, that she could quickly get a lot of notice, and that certainly worked. But screaming and yelling typically does not work in the long term in terms of building a long political career. I think she's finding that out. I think, I would never vote for Lisa Stefanik, but I do think that she would have been a stronger competitor against Kathy Hochul. than Blakeman will ever be. And so it's kind of interesting how this has worked out. I don't think that Blakeman really has any chance of being a competitive player in this race as long as he ties himself to Donald Trump. So that's sort of my quick take on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. I mean, it's the take also that Elise Stefanik had, which was, okay, but I'm this is not the person who's going to beat Kathy Hochul, if that's what our intention here is, which as a Republican running for governor, that's what I thought our intention was. Robert.
Yeah, I think Terry's absolutely right about this kind of switch from moderate to MAGA. I mean, when she first entered politics, she sort of reminded me of someone who was in that district before her, Jerry Solomon,
yes.
who started his career actually as a Democrat and yep. then switched over in 1968. Very Reagan-type, kind of had a – he was even more moderate before he entered U.S. Congress. But I think her problems, political problems inside the Trump world really started in 2021 when she was seeking the chair of the Republican conference. She and Jim Banks, Republican from Indiana, really got into it in an awful way. And Tucker Carlson's son had worked for Banks, and Don Jr. got hold of this, and he really went after Stefanik in a way that she might have been able to predict that the Trump administration would follow up. They would use her when they needed her and throw her away like they did. It's kind of tragic. And I agree with Bo. And with Terry, that the really interesting issue here is Marjorie Taylor Greene, Nancy Mace, and Elise Stefanik. They have a Mike Johnson problem, which means Trump has a Mike Johnson problem, and I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon.
No, not at all. And we will talk about what that problem is and what we make of it. Certainly, when Mike Johnson continues to anyone who listen. That he has not lost control. Jim Ketterer.
I'd like to start off first with just the politics of this state and the geography of this state. I think it's, no matter who it is, aside from Elise Stefanik specifically versus Bruce Blakeman, somebody running for statewide office from the North Country has a huge problem already. Just on the geography of the state. And I think becoming governor from the North Country is pretty darn tough. It's already unusual that we have a sitting governor from Western New York. It's almost always the case that it's somebody who has specific downstate ties and constituencies. Secondly, go back to the last election against Governor Hochul and Lee Zeldin, who I think was a very MAGA candidate and not a terribly strong candidate, came very close to winning. And so I think somebody coming out of the Republican Party on Long Island, downstate, yes, endorsed by Donald Trump, but at the same time, I think Blakeman generally doesn't come across as kind of in your face as Elise Stefanik. And so I think, you know, Joe, you mentioned George Pataki. I think that you will see the Republican Party of New York State try to position Bruce Blakeman as a Pataki kind of candidate, and that, you know, the geography plays to his advantage certainly over Stefanik and maybe over Kathy Hochul. So that's the first part, the kind of the New York State part of the analysis.
I just want to quickly add that when you look at that race in 2022, it was much closer than people initially thought it was going to be. But Hochul still won by 5 percentage points. And it was more than was expected. But it was still 5 percentage points, and Kathy Hochul won with over 50%.
Yeah, 52%. But if you look at the enrollment in the state, 5 percentage points means that either there were a great number of Democrats who didn't get up off the couch and come out and vote for her, or that switched. So that's, you know, I think obviously the motherlode of the votes is in New York City, and Mamdani won. He ran this incredible campaign. Whatever you happen to think about his political positions, his policy positions, the politics of that campaign and the way in which they ran it was really astounding. And you've seen Governor Hochul. She endorsed him very late in the game, but she did endorse him. But, you know, she's now, she and the state legislature are going to have to figure out what to do with some of the Mamdani policy requests, because the state has to sign off on a fair amount of what he wants to do. So the politics of the early Mamdani administration are going to intersect with the governor's race in a very intensive way. And if Kathy Hochul is seen as kind of obstructing Mamdani's progress, she's going to lose votes in the city, I think. But if she's seen as overly facilitating some of his more, you know, progressive policy positions, Bruce Blakeman is going to take that to the bank across the rest of the state. And so she's really in a tough position on this. In terms of Elise Stefanik and MAGA World and the Trump administration, you know, it is interesting to see that she's not going to run for Congress. And I do wonder if something is lined up for her in some way or another. We've seen the Trump administration use ambassadorial posts as a way to not only kind of reward people in a way, but also get them out of Washington and get them away, so, like Don Jr.'s former girlfriend, who's now our ambassador to Greece. And, you know, I happen to think that the chief of staff position in the White House is probably going to be coming open pretty soon. And I wouldn't be shocked to see Elise Stefanik as the new chief of staff in the White House.
Jim Ketterer on the Roundtable panel on Monday, December 22nd. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Wednesday, December 23rd, Joe Donahue was joined by semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, mayor of the city of Albany, for a few days anyway, Kathy Sheehan, and former Times Union associate editor, Mike Spain.
Today we have journalists in the room, and I really want to talk about the 60 Minutes story. It's quite something, and I think, It's the whole time that the merger was going through and there was the payoff and Colbert got booted. You thought to yourself, well, this doesn't seem like it's going to go well, right? And then we saw some new people coming into place within CBS and with 60 Minutes. So in a move that drew harsh criticism from its own correspondent, CBS abruptly removed a segment from Sunday's episode of 60 Minutes that was to feature the stories of Venezuelan men deported by the Trump administration to what the program called a, quote, brutal prison in El Salvador. CBS announced the change just 3 hours before the broadcast, a highly unusual last-minute switch. The decision was made after Barry Weiss, the new editor-in-chief of CBS News, requested numerous changes to the segment. CBS News said in a statement that the segment would air at a later date and needed, quote, additional reporting. Sharon Alfonsi, who is a veteran 60 Minutes correspondent who reported this segment, rejected that criticism in a private note to CBS colleagues on Sunday, in which she accused CBS News of pulling the segment for political reasons. And then there's this line from Sharon Alfonsi, who I just think this is really tells the story. Our story was screened 5 times. cleared by both CBS attorneys and standards and practices, Ms. Alfonsi wrote in the note, a copy of which was obtained by the New York Times. It is factually correct. In my view, pulling it now, after every rigorous internal check has been met, this is not an editorial decision. It is a political one. Ms. Weiss said in a statement late Sunday, my job is to make sure that all stories we publish are the best they can be, holding stories that aren't ready for whatever reason, that they lack sufficient context, say, or that they are missing critical voices, happens every day in every newsroom. I look forward to airing this important piece when it's ready. Sunday's unusual events have once again placed 60 Minutes at the center of a media and political fracas. And I should say, of course, 60 Minutes being one, up until maybe the past year, a gold standard in television journalism and has been for over 50 years, almost 60 years, and continues. I think many journalists there still operate under those principles that have been part of this for a very long time, and we now see sort of what they're up against. Jay.
You know, as you were reading her memo, I just wanted to cut in and go, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is the telling line in that story for me was when she handed Miller's contact information to the journalist, I think it was to the journalist who was talking out about the story. I had that happen to me once in my career, where an editor said to me that they wanted some more reporting on it, and have you spoken to so and so? I have their number right here, and it was clear that they had, you know, cut in on that. But the fact that the administration had not commented on the story, they had stonewalled them on the story, and then the boss is saying, I want you to call. The administration wants to talk to you about this.
Right. Then the Barry Weiss turns and says, call.
I think it was Miller.
Stephen Miller.
Yeah.
You need Stephen Miller on this, the White House Deputy Chief of Staff. And the architect of Trump's immigration crackdown. So
with a good editor, saying you need additional reporting on it is a very credible thing to say. In this case, it's not a credible thing to say. 60 Minutes did their work on this, as the reporter noted that this was you know, it was worked on, it was cleared, it was screened 5 times. I didn't know they did that kind of thing, but all this was just a veto by the administration over a story they didn't want to get in, and I think it really hurts their credibility. I think Barry Weiss's days at CBS are numbered after this.
But they got what they wanted, right? I mean, the person they wanted in there.
And I think, you know, presumably Paramount Skydance is going to get what they want in the way of getting Netflix.
Yes.
But I don't think journalistically I think this could be the straw that broke the camel's back at CBS.
Ms. Weiss also questioned the use of the term migrants to describe the Venezuelan men who were deported, noting that they were in the United States illegally. Mike Spain.
I'll be a little contrarian to my longtime colleague, Jay. An editor has to make a tough decision, and she was, whether you like it or not, and I'm not happy I was very concerned when Barry Weiss was named head of all of CBS News. But she's the editor, and she does have to have a responsibility for making calls. Now, there are different versions of this story out there. Mm-hmm. Did the administration refuse to comment, or did they only issue statements? And what Barry Weiss wanted was to have a guy on camera or a woman on camera with their voice on the story to give it quote-unquote balance. There's this debate going on, and we just don't know all the details of it. But certainly Axios reported that, you know, there were comments, and they didn't include them because they weren't new, and they didn't respond specifically to some of their questions. But you could say the administration has consistently said dot, 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 and that might have covered it. Who knows? She also said that this will air. And in a way, that'll get more eyeballs than it would have on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the way it backfires on the administration. The New York Times, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, especially if General Fonsi is the one introducing the piece and says, by the way.
Yeah, right, yeah. And it'll be very interesting to watch it play out. I don't think this is over. If it ends up carrying a perfunctory denial or refuting by some administration spokesperson and errs, and it's as powerful as it is, I mean, it's out there. Yeah. You can see it. And these Venezuelans who were just, you know, out of a couple of hundred Venezuelans, eight of them were had serious criminal records, and the rest did nothing or very little. And yes, the New York Times reported that 2 months ago, but 60 Minutes, Washington Post, ABC News, you name it, they all do stories that other media do, and they amplify it. And they bring, in the case of television, they bring you the visual and the audio of somebody actually saying something, which can be a lot more compelling than just reading it. Mm-hmm. And it will have impact if it is published. I mean, I'd like to see how this plays out. She's brand new. Like I said, I don't think she had the resume that made her qualified for the job that CBS put her in to. But in the end, let's see what she does at this point. I mean, an editor has to make tough decisions. I've delayed stories so that people had comments on them.
So in her note, Ms. Alfonsi said that her team had requested comment from the White House, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security. As you rightly point out, there were many there are a couple narratives out there about what happened here. But she said, Ms. Alfonsi said, if the administration's refusal to participate becomes a valid reason to spike a story, we have effectively handed them a kill switch for any reporting they find inconvenient. Reach on Sunday evening, Ms. Alfonsi said, I refer all questions to Barry Weiss.
Well, if only it had been that easy for me as mayor to kill the many stories that your publication wrote.
Yep. Right. Now they tell me.
Me. If only I had known. But I just want to say that, first of all, the story is out because apparently it's streamed in Canada.
Right.
And so the story as it was meant to be seen on Sunday
it
is accessible. Thank you, Canada. But I also think that, you know, as we look at why, right, mm-hmm. why would the administration want to kill this story? I think that Americans need to understand the consequences of the complete and utter failure of this administration to provide even the bare minimum of due process to people. And America, our country, sent these people to this brutal, horrible place. And we can say, and the administration seems to take the position of, well, that's not us. They were here illegally, and we deported them. And what happened to them when they got there? Well, that's not on us. And I don't know how any person can listen to these stories and watch what has happened to people who have been denied due process and not take pause. Because if it can happen to them, it can happen to anyone. And I think that is the real story here. And the conversation that we need to get to, and that these are ways of getting to that underlying stories. These are human beings. You know, I think when we look at what people may have been deported for, and people have to realize that if a person who is here legally gets pulled over for drunk driving, shoplifts, you know, these are pretty minor offenses as we would look at them, right? You know, if your kid gets arrested for shoplifting, I don't think that you think, oh, yeah, it's okay for you to send them to a supermax prison in another country where they're going to get beaten and tortured. And so this is where I think the conversation needs to get to. And again, I think that's what the administration is trying to tamp down. And this is because of their failure to actually come up with real implementable immigration policy and pass it through Congress.
But the other problem, too, is that the the administration was upset over the Marjorie Taylor Greene story on 60 Minutes. They spoke out about that and said, and Trump said that he didn't want, he didn't like that story. And he there's this, I don't think this is any secret, and I don't think I'm being offering commentary here. I think it's true that the president of whether it be his Justice Department or the FBI or the Department of War, he feels that it is his. Because those are in control. And it feels as though with the deals that were made with CBS and with the deals that the payoff and the...
Do you mean the $15 million settlement that CBS made to Trump?
Indeed, that is exactly what I mean. And then the subsequent firing of Stephen Colbert. And then Barry Weiss being put in this position to keep it under control, it just seems that I think you have an argument to be made that that Trump sees this as his, that he's done something for them and they should be doing things for him. And one of those things is to kill stories that make the administration look bad.
I think that's true, and I think that I get everything you're saying, Mike. I think thinking back when I was a reporter or a junior editor or a less senior editor.
By the way, just both as journalists, you'd be ticked. You'd be in the Alfonsi camp if you were the reporter.
I'd be furious.
Absolutely.
And I'd be furious for this reason, for exactly the reason the mayor touched on very humorously, thank you, is that you don't want people in power thinking that they have a kill switch. That's even if that's not what happened, even if Barry Weiss had a legitimate reason or two to say, let's tweak it just a little bit more, let's get a live interview with Miller, let's get somebody on camera, maybe we can get the president, maybe we can, you know, get somebody, maybe we could even get the president of El Salvador in this. But even if you have all those reasons, to give them even the feeling that they have control over the story is a dangerous, dangerous thing. And I knew that as a reporter long ago, and pushed back very hard when I felt that editors were doing that.
Timing is everything. And if you miss the window where you have the public's attention, the story won't have the impact, mm-hmm. and the work will not have gotten seen by the right number of people in time for something, for example. Yep. Like if there's an election coming up and you're writing a story about a politician who might have engaged in domestic violence right on the eve of election day. And if you hold that story another week so you can check it all out, you deny the public the access or the ability to know that information. However, if you are wrong about the story or it just isn't accurate, you've done another disservice. I mean, it's a tough situation for an editor on a deadline.
It's called a Comey problem.
Yeah, a Comey problem. Right. There's a lot of problems that could be made.
But what we have is a president who is systematically looking to silence any criticism.
Right.
And that's because we have someone who became president and is motivated by wanting to be adored and unquestioned. And as I look at public service, and I can joke about the coverage that I received over the last 12 years, because I didn't do this job to become adored. This isn't about creating a cult of personality. This is about making difficult decisions, policy decisions, that while people may disagree with them, you should be able to explain them. They should be able to understand them. And when I look at what we have now, this is not normal, and we keep saying that. But if you look at Project 2025 and what the goal was, this is all part of that playbook. I mean, I don't think anyone should be surprised at what we're seeing here. But I think this is what happens, you know, and we've had presidents in the past who, you know, very much needed their ego to be stoked. But this is a president that has taken it to a whole new level. And this is what we're seeing.
Well, I say this only as a friend, Kathy, but You have 8 days to start naming stuff after yourself. I mean, the Sheehan Palace Theater. The Kathy's Capital Rep. I mean, get going.
As I have said, I will come back and haunt anyone who tries to name anything after me. And so, But this is what it looks like. And it's really dangerous, especially with somebody who has access to the billions of dollars of capital that this president has.
I think also, and I assume most people would agree, this program has such a sterling reputation. And yes, there have been times where it has gone to court.
But it's gold standard.
It's gold standard. Yeah. And even in the times, whether it be Westmoreland or the Dan Rather affair, I mean, these are things that were worked out, were questioned, were brought to attention, were worked out in court, and consequences were taken. I think very few news outlets don't have something in the that. It shows how good they are to be able to have things that are questioned and perhaps are run a fine line as to what is or is not appropriate. With that said, do things like this, which seems to be part of the motive here, at least to me, seems to be part of the motive here, is to also cut down on the credibility of a program that would then cut down on the audience of a program, which would then cut down on the need to have it be their premier program.
Well, I think you were onto something when you talked about the way Trump reacted to the Marjorie Taylor Greene interview and the fact that Trump had sued successfully and won a $15 million settlement against CBS after 60 Minutes edited, quote-unquote, an interview with Kamala Harris from last year before the election. And knowing how litigious he is, and if you know someone is litigious, you're going to be extra careful to remove those those opportunities for them to pounce on you. So if I'm not saying I agree with Barry Weiss, but she is in a position where she has to balance the credibility of the program that had been, and I'll say had been, the gold standard for broadcast journalism, and risking giving the administration another hammer to use to pound on its credibility.
Mike Spain on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, December 22nd. We'll be back with more after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Friday, December 26th, Joe was on vacation and I moderated the panel. I was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Tetherless World Senior Constellation Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. When the Trump administration announced plans last month to redistribute billions of dollars in homelessness aid, the move capped a conservative attack on the once bipartisan philosophy that has guided federal work for a generation, an approach called Housing First. Housing First provides chronically homeless people long-term subsidized housing and offers, but does not require, treatment for mental illness or addiction. It contrasts with programs that condition help on sobriety or work, which Trump officials want to encourage, though there is less direct research to suggest the efficacy of programs that prioritize treatment before housing. The administration called the policy a permissive approach that has let homelessness rise. Supporters say Housing First was backed by proven science and few aid policies have been studied as extensively as Housing First. In seeking new rules to guide $3.9 billion in grants, the administration would sharply limit Housing First and promote treatment-focused alternatives. Extensive research shows that Housing First places large shares of its clients in housing, and it also appears to have played a major role in cutting homelessness among veterans, which had fallen by more than half. At the same time, Housing First programs have not consistently improved clients' mental or physical health, as the success in finding housing would have predicted. Housing First supporters say homelessness has grown for one reason. Affordable housing has vanished, rents have soared, wages have lagged, and federal housing aid reaches fewer than one in four eligible households. Only a much larger Housing First program, supporters say, would overcome the headwinds of the problems in the economy that spread and proliferate and increase homelessness. Nick, do you want to start?
Well, I've been talking about this for several months because early drafts of the administrative change to the Notice of Funding Opportunities, the NOFO, by HUD, had been circulated over the summer. And so many of the homelessness providers, the providers like Legal Aid Society, which does ongoing rent support for about 23 families in Albany that assists just keeping people housed through the COC here in the Capital Region, and then the dozens of other organizations. We all meet very regularly and we talk about this program, the COC program, and our portion, which is called LARF. I'll try not to get too much in the weeds.
Feel free to get in the weeds. It's helpful.
So for several generations, as noted in the article, the Housing First model really relied on the notion that getting somebody housed and stable was the first step to getting them into addiction services or getting them mental health or physical health support, getting them on benefits that they're entitled to, evaluating whether they have a disability and need other kinds of financial support that they're entitled to by law. But the way the program works now is there are COCs across the country that distribute funding from HUD to partners, to homelessness providers of various types, and there's short-term types and longer-term types. And there are programs that focus on families and programs that focus on individuals, veterans, different types, right? And New York and California have the most COC-funded programs in the country. One's around 800 and one's around 900. The third most organizations that work under this program is Florida with less than like 400. And so there's this sort of undercurrent of the shift to focus on a different kind of homelessness prevention back to a temporary support with work requirements that, if allowed to move forward, would redistribute federal funding to states other than New York and California. And so when you scale back and look globally, what is the current split of short-term and long-term funding, which is, I think it's like 70 and 30, and what is the current practice of continuing to fund a program at its previous level at a reliable level of about 80%, those programs in New York and California and everywhere else, they know they're going to get continued funding. They know generally that they'll be able to provide the same kind of housing support. So then those states like New York then fund the building of homelessness shelters, or they fund the creation of units for temporary housing or affordable housing with temporary units. So these things come together with this kind of expectation or this reliance on some stability in that funding program. What HUD is trying to do and what Trump has been talking about doing since he took office is flipping that on its head and flipping from 70-30 to a 30-70, flipping from an 80% reliable continued funding to 20% of your funding being reliably continued into the next year. This is on the backdrop of deep cuts to HUD and HUD programs and HUD funds following a shutdown that dramatically slowed or will not pay back certain kinds of housing vouchers. So experts in the field of homelessness and homelessness prevention are both fighting to prevent those new regulations to go into effect, which there is an injunction and they have been rolled back, but that the administration has committed to continuing to try to make those changes, whether they have to do it through regulation or they have to do it through statute. And it just makes everything unstable and chaotic. And at this moment, a lot of organizations just feel like the federal government is the agent of chaos. My organization decided to not reapply for its funding under this program because it was tying these new work requirements, 40 hours of work, case management, mental health, or addiction services that somebody has to track for this person and maintain. And some organization has to be able to provide those services to an influx of people that are not currently seeking those services. And anyone who's been trying to get a mental health counselor right now knows that there are not mental health counselors available. They are particularly not available overnight for this influx of new individuals who are demanding some help to achieve this arbitrary 40-hour requirement. So not only would we not be able to supervise that, because it isn't available to people right now, but then if they don't achieve that 40 hours, we would be required to cut off their rent assistance, become essentially a person who has created an eviction case for somebody who can't pay rent, which is not sustainable for an organization like mine, and it's not sustainable for many others. And so you're seeing organizations backing out of the program because they know that they can't meet the new requirements. Spark in Schenectady, which is a harm reduction organization, would be precluded under this program from accessing those funds. And so they were also not going to apply. And so then you have the chaos piece is, well, now that NOFO has been rescinded and now they're going back to the drawing board and they're going to try to do the same things but from a different angle. Well, this application's due like yesterday. Right. So how do you then get back into that game? It's impossible.
And without applying for and acquiring that funding, there's a deficit for your organization and Spark?
For a smaller organization, there would be a deficit. I think our organization is large enough that we've really been able to absorb changes at the federal level because the state has invested so much money into housing issues and eviction prevention. But the families that we're currently supporting under that particular HUD grant, we won't be able to support after August, which is very destabilizing for those folks. I mean, the point in time count of homelessness families in Albany doubled last year already, mm-hmm. and now we're looking at potentially exploding numbers.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Jim, you don't have to email in. You can just speak into your microphone.
Oh, wow. Hey, I've been typing all the time. Nick was talking. I think the thing that hits me about this is the general feeling of the Trump administration is if there's overwhelming evidence scientifically in one direction and a few people who disagree in another direction, then the issue is up for grabs, right? The notion of evidence-based, the notion of seeing what works, notion of trying experiments. I mean, remember the Supreme Court in overturning the abortion rules said, we think states should be the places that get to explore and test these things, that when there's evidence, you know, that can be found. But then the Trump administration's view, it's far more worth at HHS mm-hmm. than anywhere else, is who cares? We have this overwhelming scientific consensus for X, and we have these couple people who we're going to put in our team who disagree. And they may disagree for decent reasons, but usually the disagreement has as much to do with politics and things like that as anything else. When you look at this Housing First policies, they have been shown to significantly reduce homelessness, as Nick points out, particularly in veterans. It really depends what your goal is. Is your goal to help people and give them stability so that they can help themselves if they want? Or are you going to go with a model that just sort of says, well, we have this way we're going to try, and if it works, you know, it'll look good politically, and if it doesn't work, so what? And I think Nick's right. It's implicitly anti-blue state. It's implicitly it's feeding into this myth that anyone who doesn't have a job, that can't hold something down, that's having personal problems, that it's their fault. It's the Protestant work ethic. It's a lot of other names for it. But, you know, again, I live in a family where one of the people, my kid, is seriously disabled by, multiple sclerosis, which does not present in the same way as many other things do. They're physically able to sometimes do things, but not other times, things like that. And, you know, the notion of a 40-hour work requirement for their health care would be ridiculous. It would mean that my wife and I go from supporting them mostly to supporting them completely. And my kid's lucky because we could probably afford most of that. But, if we weren't well off, and reasonably well off, the old definition of middle class, they'd be out on the street. And under this new policy, not only would they be out on the street, but they wouldn't be eligible for being put somewhere that they could take care of themselves.
Teresa?
Yeah, I think that this is just one, I shouldn't say just, but this is one part of an overall attack on HUD, the Housing and Urban Development budget. You know, this is one anecdotal example of a there's some people approaching it philosophically. I'd say Russ Vogt and J.D. Vance and those folks are real true believers that the federal government should not be involved in these kinds of things. And then I think there's other people who are approaching this from a political point of view, which is, as you both rightly point out, this really will shift funding from California and New York and what people call blue states or Democratic-held states to red states in a big way. And all of this, just like healthcare, what they're doing with healthcare, it's dismantling, but not putting anything in place that's viable, that's practical, that's really nothing. It's a lot of words, but not programs. And also doing it with no transition, right? There's no interim period to shift from one to the other. It's so abrupt, just like shutting down USAID. Right, and totally dismantling it in a matter of days and weeks. And what's the result of that? Hundreds of thousands of people have literally lost their lives, as people have documented, right? And I think the result of this, you think about this, particularly the impact it will have on veterans. So at the same time as they are proposing to cut another 30,000 jobs from the VA, which is, that's just unfathomable, right? And they have already cut a lot of jobs. It's another story I heard yesterday where this person, three or four people around him were pushed out, and he's supposed to be doing his job and everybody else's and properly serving veterans. It's not possible. And these are physicians' positions, but there's nurses' positions that aren't being filled. There's caseworker positions that aren't being filled. And the same thing's going to happen with this. And so, we have to call it what it is, which is a dismantling of housing assistance in this country. And it will result in an explosion of homelessness. People will be out on the streets, and then they will talk about, in particularly in urban areas, and they will be homeless in rural areas. You just don't see it in the same way you see it in urban areas. And they will be homeless at the same time. They don't have access to health care. They don't have access to mental health. They don't have access to food. And then the Republicans will talk about how, you know, the Democratic-led cities are being mismanaged, right? But then I go back to Pope Leo's message, right? And what is the role for each of us, for all of us? And we can stop this from happening. 5 Republican House members can stop this from happening, right? And they can step up and say, no, you can't spend congressional dollars the way you choose, Trump administration. This is a change in policy. You need a change in legislation, right? They could step in. And it's not that there isn't room to improve our housing policy, but this is really just a dismantling. And it's easy to tear things down, harder to build them back up.
I do like to remind people that a tremendous percent of people experiencing homelessness have children, and those children are also homeless. And so when we talk about ending homelessness programs, it's not just an adult being impacted, and not to say just an adult, but it's not just an adult being impacted, or it is their whole household. And that can have ripple effects into other facets of that child's life. It impacts their ability to learn. It impacts their ability to break their own cycles of poverty. And so when we're thinking, what does homelessness policy need to look like? It really has to be holistic, and it's not. What I would say about the change in the housing first model isn't only the transitionary or long-term permanent housing piece. The NOFO also included efforts to target blue cities versus red cities by including language that programs in cities like Albany would be demerited it because the city has sanctuary policies in place. And sanctuary just meaning that the city doesn't spend its own money assisting federal agencies in its law enforcement of immigration policies. It doesn't mean that they're hiding people from the law, right? It just means we have a budgetary priority that is not the same priority as the federal administration. It also punishes cities that have not adopted laws that criminalize outdoor sleeping and homelessness, where some cities like Saratoga have passed laws that say we will arrest you, we will use law enforcement methods, incarceration as a means of moving homeless people, people experiencing homelessness out of those city bounds. It also prioritizes programs that explicitly state that it only identifies binary genders, male, female, which in the state of New York is illegal. Transgender people, gender nonconforming people are protected by the constitution of the state. And so that language being attached to funding opportunities is itself problematic and is attempting to undermine the rights of states to pass its own laws and to protect its citizens. And so these things are coming together in NOFOs for all of the programs that the federal government is funds. And so each time there's a new grant application, you see similar language because that is the way that the federal government is attempting to undercut the laws of the states that have adopted protections for example, trans kids. And so it is very complicated, and it's hard to keep an eye on, but we have to stay focused on, like, where is the money and why is the money changing?
That's Nick Rangel on the Roundtable panel yesterday morning. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at WAMC.org. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.